And I want to thank all of you for your interest in our topic this evening. I guess you're part of a series of studies in apologetics. And tonight you're here to discuss with me and to think about with me the topic of the problem of evil. And I would like to say a few things that are introductory about this problem, and then we'll jump into some of the tricky details, the technical issues related to the problem. Some of the things that I will say to you tonight are supported in greater detail or developed more fully in some of the books that I brought with me. And afterwards, if you'd like to browse the table and take a look at some of these things, you're welcome to do that. Two books that are especially pertinent to our topic in a general way will be the book Evil and the Evidence for God, which I wrote for Temple University Press. That's on the table. And then a collection of articles under the title Contemporary Perspectives on Religious Epistemology. I will refer in particular to one of the articles in this book, an article written by an atheist friend of mine named William Rowe on the problem of evil. And that would be a source for his article as well as other things related to the problem of evil and to the evidence for the existence of God, which is our topic this evening. Now, there are special cases of the problem of evil. Our topic tonight is general. We're going to talk about the problem of evil in a very general way and talk about some strategies for thinking about the problem of evil and responding to people who raise this as an objection to the rationality of belief in God. But some people raise obstacles for belief in God or for belief in Jesus Christ that do not seem to be formulations of the problem of evil, but really are special cases of the problem of evil. For example, many people stumble over the question, is God fair if he does not save all who never have the opportunity to hear the gospel of Jesus Christ? This is a question about divine fairness. Though it's focused on salvation and God's fairness with respect to the unevangelized, it's a very focused, specialized issue there, it still is a species of the problem of evil. And that will not be our topic tonight. But things that we say tonight, things that we discuss together tonight, will have a bearing on that question as well. And if you're especially interested in that question, then there are two other books on the table that might be of interest to you. There's a book there called Four Views on Salvation in a Pluralistic World. It's on the far end of the table there, published by Zondervan. And it includes contributions by people like John Hick and Clark Pinnock, Alistair McGrath, and myself. And it discusses this very question, what about the unevangelized, as well as related issues and the justice of God. Then a chapter that I've contributed to the book Jesus Under Fire is titled Is Jesus the Only Way? And here again is a chapter-long treatment of the specialized problem of evil concerning salvation or soteriology for those who've never heard, or indeed for some who've heard but still for some reason or other do not believe. So that is a little indication of some of the resources that I brought with me that are available to you at a discount because you're part of this course tonight. As we get underway, I'd like for us to ask the question, what is the problem of evil? Now, in a moment, I'm going to make a distinction between two general formulations of the argument from evil. But before we make that distinction, I want to give a characterization in very general terms of the problem. This will help us then when we make this distinction in a few moments between what is sometimes called the logical argument from evil and what is sometimes called the evidential argument from evil. But first, what more generally is the problem of evil? The problem of evil is part of a family of problems, a nest of obstacles that have been stumbling blocks for people who would believe that God exists or that Christianity is true. It's not the only problem. Clearly, that's indicated by the fact that you've had a series of lecturers come in and lecture on a variety of topics, other problems in defense of the faith. This is only one of many. Now, this particular problem is one of the more notorious problems. And historically, it has been regarded as probably the number one obstacle to belief in God. Now, a little bit more by way of general characterization here before we look at special formulations of the problem. When we speak of the problem of evil, we're talking about a kind of obstacle to the rationality of belief in God. It's supposed to be an obstacle to belief in God understood a certain way. God believed to be morally perfect and all-powerful. And you might say, all-knowing. If God is morally perfect, omnipotent or all-powerful, having all the power that one logically could have, and God is all-knowing, omniscient, then why is there evil in the world? On the face of it, it looks like there wouldn't be evil in the world if God is like that, if God has these three properties. Because if God is good, you would expect that He would want to prevent evil. That would be part of His goodness. His desire would be to prevent evil. If He's all-powerful, then He could act on His will and His goodness and His desire and prevent evil because He has the power to. And if He's all-knowing, then He can anticipate in advance whether evil will happen or not based on other things that He does with His power in accordance with His goodness. Right? Now, this is the intuition that drives almost all formulations of the problem of evil. But we need to say a little bit more that's still general here. Because problems in philosophical parlance are called defeaters. And there are two types of defeaters. Maybe one of the other lecturers in this series has already introduced to you this distinction between two different types of defeaters that I want to talk about for just a moment. You could think then of obstacles to theistic belief or belief in God as defeaters of the justification one could have for believing that God exists. They undermine in some way the justification that you have for believing some proposition. And in this case, the key proposition is going to be something to do with the existence of God. What are the two types of defeaters that philosophers talk about? One type of defeater is called a rebutting defeater by epistemologists like John Pollock. A rebutting defeater directly attacks a claim that one would make or the conclusion of someone's argument. In this case, let us say that the claim is that God is morally perfect, omnipotent, and omniscient. Right? A rebutting defeater would offer evidence that that claim is false. A rebutting defeater then would take the form of an argument with the conclusion that that's not true about God. God is not morally perfect, all-powerful, and omniscient. Now, God may be two of the three things, but not all three. Or God may be one of the three things, but not all three. Or it may be that God has none of these properties. All of these would be different formulations of the claim that God is not morally perfect, omniscient, and omnipotent. And a rebutting defeater would take the form of presenting evidence or an argument that this is the case. In other words, it directly attacks your belief in mind that this is what God is like. The other type of defeater is sometimes called an undermining defeater or undercutting defeater. Instead of attacking our belief directly, or instead of attacking the conclusion of some argument that we would give for the existence of God, an undermining defeater attacks the evidence that we offer in support of our belief. So, for example, if I offer an argument for the existence of God, a cosmological argument for the existence of God, somebody might attempt to produce an undermining defeater of my belief in God by arguing that my argument for the existence of God, my cosmological argument, just isn't a very good argument. It doesn't adequately support the conclusion that God exists. Now notice, with an undermining defeater, the opponent is not claiming that your belief is necessarily false. Your opponent is claiming that your belief is not adequately supported by the evidence that you propose. And so this is a claim about whether you're justified in believing that God exists on the basis of the evidence that you've presented. And if the undermining defeater is successful, and that indeed is the evidence that you have for believing that God exists, then this opponent will have succeeded in showing that your belief is not justified. It is not adequately grounded in the evidence. Now, the question before us would be, is the problem of evil one of these two types of defeaters? Is it a rebutting defeater, or is it an undermining defeater? If it functions as a rebutting defeater, then the problem of evil takes the form of an argument that God does not exist. Or it takes the form of an argument that belief in God is not justified, is not reasonable, is not rational. Now that's an important difference. And you get different formulations of the problem of evil depending upon which of those two beliefs you're attacking with your rebutting defeater from evil. What are those two beliefs again? One is God exists, and the other is it is reasonable to believe that God exists. These are two different claims. These are two different claims. It's one thing to believe that God exists. It's another thing to believe that it's reasonable to believe that God exists. Right? You could believe that God exists and for some reason believe that it's not especially reasonable to believe that God exists. Or you might believe that it is reasonable to believe that God exists and yet not believe that God exists. And clearly, your belief has a different object in each case. Here, the object of your belief is the existence of God. Here, the object of your belief is a belief. Now, the existence of God and a belief about the existence of God are not the same thing. So, the problem of evil may be offered as a rebutting defeater of either one of these two things. It may be offered as an argument that this claim that God exists is false, or it may be offered as an argument that this claim that belief in God is reasonable is false. Now, in the case where the defeater is acting in this second way against this conclusion, it has a relationship to an undermining defeater. It has a relationship to an undermining defeater. Because I might say, I believe that God exists. And here's the evidence that God exists. The opponent comes along and says, but I don't think your evidence is strong enough to overcome countervailing evidence, competing evidence, right, for the non-existence of God. And my opponent might say, now this evidence for the non-existence of God doesn't prove that God does not exist, but it does have to be part of the equation. So that when you offer positive evidence, it's got to be strong enough to overcome the negative evidence. If you set the negative evidence in one side of the balance, you set the positive evidence in the other side of the balance, which way do the scales tip? And it may be that they don't tip strongly for or against belief in God, and the best thing to do is to withhold belief. But evil has now functioned as evidence that weakens the strength of your evidence for believing that God exists. And in that sense, it might function as an undermining defeater. Now, these kinds of distinctions can be helpful because when you're talking to somebody who raises the problem of evil, a decision about how best to respond to that person can be facilitated by a decision about how the argument from evil is functioning for that opponent. What is it that the opponent is trying to accomplish? Is the opponent trying to show that God does not exist? Or is the opponent trying to show that it's unreasonable to believe that God exists? Or is the opponent trying to show that the evidence you presented, right, is either canceled or counterbalanced by evidence from evil so that you need a stronger case than you've already presented to justify your belief that God exists? These are all possibilities. All right, so now we can look a little bit more intently at two popular formulations of the argument from evil. I've characterized it as the intuition, generally, that if God was morally perfect, all-powerful, and omniscient, then there wouldn't be evil. Because a morally perfect God would want to prevent evil, an all-powerful God could, and an omniscient being could anticipate it, see it coming before it happens, and prevent it. But now, let's get more precise. And let's distinguish two versions of the argument from evil, where the argument now is functioning as a kind of defeater. We'll ask the question of both formulations. Which type of defeater is it? Is it an undermining defeater or a rebutting defeater? The first formulation of the argument from evil is often called the deductive argument from evil. Sometimes it's called the logical argument from evil. And we'll use the term logical. The goal of the logical argument from evil is to demonstrate that believing that God is morally perfect, omnipotent, and omniscient is incompatible with believing in the reality of evil. You cannot consistently believe that God is morally perfect, omnipotent, and omniscient, and at the same time believe that there's evil in the world. This is the logical argument from evil. Now, for our purposes, let us simplify and just talk about whether it is consistent to believe three things together. God is morally perfect, God is omnipotent, and evil is a reality. Notice what we've left out, the omniscience of God. Now, I think we can do that in this case, partly because many atheists who like this form of the argument leave it out, and also because you could assimilate, if you're careful, you could assimilate the concept of divine omniscience to the concept of divine omnipotence, at least for the purposes of understanding the permission of evil. All right? So now the question is, can one consistently believe, that is, believe without contradiction, these three propositions? God is all-powerful, God is morally perfect, and evil exists. Evil is a reality. Let's take this argument and see what kind of response might be made. First of all, we need to ask, where exactly is the contradiction here? Where exactly is the contradiction? On the face of it, it's not immediately obvious that evil is incompatible with the existence of a morally perfect, omnipotent God. So in order for this to constitute a contradiction, believing these three things, then believing these three things must involve, entail, commitment to other assumptions that have not yet been made explicit. The idea would be that if God is all-powerful, He could prevent evil. There's the assumption. Back of the claim that omnipotence is problematic here, because omnipotence entails that God could prevent evil. And goodness entails that God would want to, that a morally perfect God would want to prevent all evil. So what we need to do is examine these assumptions and consider whether they're necessarily true. Let's take the assumption that an all-powerful God could prevent any and all evil. It seems that that would be true only on the condition that God does not create free creatures. Right? That would be true only on the assumption that God does not create free creatures, or on the condition that God does not create free creatures. But suppose God does create free creatures, human beings with freedom, genuine freedom, like you and I have, such that those creatures are able to make free decisions without external constraint by their conditioning or their environment or God Himself. Now, His power would not be limited by the fact that He created free creatures, because He would still be as powerful as He needs to be all powerful, if that just means He can do everything that it is logically possible to do. But it wouldn't be logically possible, right, to support the real, genuine freedom of a free creature and yet make that creature do with his or her will what he wants. Now, God could determine the will of a being, if you want to call it the will of a being. If it's determined, what in what sense is it the will of the being that's determined? You could thwart the will of a being and make that being act a certain way, but then that creature would not be free. So maybe this assumption that an all-powerful God would be able to prevent evil is itself false, unless he just decides not to create free creatures at all. And then the question is a world with free creatures who might sin or might do evil a better world or a worse world than a world with no free creatures at all? And it could be argued, I think, that these worlds are very difficult to compare morally. How do you compare a world with creatures who do not have moral properties because they do not have moral freedom with a world where there are genuinely free creatures capable of moral responsibility and hence capable of morally good as well as morally bad acts? How would you compare them? How would you say that one was morally better than the other? And on what grounds would you prefer a world where there were no free creatures over a world where there are free creatures like yourself? So that's one problem with the logical argument from evil. It makes assumptions about the power of God that are themselves questionable. Now look at the assumption about God's goodness. Does the goodness of God entail that God could not will to permit any evil? And of course, the answer to that depends on whether God's permission of evil is for a greater good. In fact, we've already suggested that human freedom is itself a good which justifies God's risking the introduction of evil on the part of free creatures. So great is the good of human freedom that God creates free creatures and thereby establishes the real possibility that free creatures will sin, a possibility that God in His omniscience knows is going to be actualized. But why? Because of a greater good. So He will act for the good and for the greater good, but that doesn't mean that because He's morally perfect, He will act in order to prevent all evil, especially if some evils establish conditions for certain goods, like the good of human freedom. And in a little bit, we'll talk about some other goods that may be made possible by God's permission of evil. Now, this, in a nutshell, permits the conclusion that the logical argument from evil does not stand. There really is no logical contradiction between our three propositions. God is morally perfect, God is all-powerful, and yet evil exists. These three things can all be true without contradiction. Now, many of my students ask me, well, when you give a response like that to a famous argument from evil, what do atheists say in response? In this case, it's very interesting to note that contemporary atheistic philosophers, by and large, accept this evaluation of the argument. And they no longer endorse the logical argument from evil. Let me give you an example from this article that I said I would refer to by William Rowe. This article is titled "The Problem of Evil and Some Varieties of Atheism." And the focus of his argument is an argument of a rather different kind. But in the first footnote, which is on page 41 of this book, William Rowe says this: "Some philosophers have contended that the existence of evil is logically inconsistent with the existence of the theistic God." That's the logical argument from evil. Now, when he says some philosophers have made this claim, he doesn't clearly indicate how many in the past used to do this and how many up until fairly recently used to do this. Perhaps most famously, within our contemporary world, the now deceased atheist philosopher J.L. Mackey endorsed an argument of this kind in his book, The Miracle of Theism. He thought it was a miracle that anyone should believe that God exists, given the evidence against the existence of God. And not so many years ago, his book was published by Oxford University Press, in which he endorsed the logical argument from evil. I recently read an article by another philosopher, a very sophisticated philosopher named Quentin Smith, in which he gives two arguments against the existence of God, and one of them is the logical argument from evil. So there are a few people today or recently who have claimed that this is a good argument. But now listen to what Rowe says. "Some philosophers have contended that the existence of evil is logically inconsistent with the existence of the theistic God. No one, I think, has succeeded in establishing such an extravagant claim." Now, you've got to understand that Professor Rowe of Purdue University is himself an atheist. He says, "Indeed, granted incompatibilism, that is, granting a certain rich conception of human freedom, there is a fairly compelling argument for the view that the existence of evil is logically consistent with the existence of a theistic God. And then he references the Christian philosopher Alvin Plantinga and his work, which has effectively demonstrated the logical compatibility between those three propositions: God is all-powerful, God is morally perfect, and yet evil exists. So what does Rose say? The jig is up. There is no argument from evil that the atheist could count on against theistic belief? Not quite. He goes on in the same footnote, there remains, however, what we may call the evidential form, as opposed to the logical form, of the problem of evil. This is the view that the variety and profusion of evil in our world, although perhaps not logically inconsistent with the existence of the theistic God, provides nevertheless rational support for atheism. In this article, I shall be concerned solely with the evidential form of the problem, the form of the problem which I think presents a rather severe difficulty for theism. All right? So as far as this atheist philosopher is concerned, even though he allows that the logical argument from evil fails as an argument for atheism, there is still a potent, persuasive form of the argument from evil that is effective. And that brings us to what he called, and what we'll call, the evidential argument from evil. What is the evidential argument from evil? Remember that an alternative term, name for the logical argument from evil is that it's a deductive argument from evil. An alternative name for the evidential argument from evil is that it is a probabilistic argument from evil. The evidence of evil, according to the evidential argument from evil, does not entail that God does not exist. According to the logical argument from evil, evil entails the non-existence of God. Either God is not all-powerful, or God is not morally perfect, or He's neither one. But according to the evidential problem, evil only makes it very likely that God does not exist. Evil makes it likely that God does not exist. Now, I'll say a little bit more about that particular logical point in a moment, but now I want to clarify something else. The proponent of the logical argument from evil might believe that any evil whatsoever is incompatible with the existence of God. That you could take any evil feature of the world and argue from that against the existence of God. Now, the atheist might not want to do that. He might want to say, well, you know, some evils are compatible with the existence of God, but not all evils. But he could go either way on that. In fact, he'd probably have a better way, he'd probably have more going for him if he argued that any evil is incompatible with the existence of God. Because as soon as you say, well, some evils are and others evils are not, then you've got to say, now what's so special about those evils that make it incompatible with the existence of God? How are those evils different from the others? But now notice in the case of the evidential argument from evil, most proponents, most atheists who like this argument, allow that some evils do not have this bearing on the question, does God exist? But their point is that there are evils, if not all evils, there are some evils that are such that they make it very unlikely that God exists. Sure, it's still logically possible that God exists. There's no contradiction there. It's just unreasonable. Okay? Just because three propositions are not contradictory doesn't mean it makes sense to believe that they're all true. It makes sense to believe that they all could be true, but it doesn't follow from the fact that they all could be true that it is reasonable to believe they all are true. And this is the point the evidentialist makes. He wants to say that even though all three propositions could be true without contradiction, some of the evils in the world are such that it's rather unlikely that they're all true. It's unlikely that God exists. It's unlikely either that God is morally perfect or that God is all-powerful. Now, why is that? Because of the profusion and character of some of these evils. What do we mean by the profusion of evil? What does the word profusion refer to? Amount. It concerns quantity. So there's something about the actual quantity of evil that we discover in the world that makes it less likely that God exists. The idea then seems to be that if there was just less evil in the world than we actually encounter, then it wouldn't be as unlikely that God exists. It's the fact that there's so much evil that makes it unlikely. One would think that if God was morally perfect, and if God was all-powerful, He wouldn't want to permit the amount of evil that we have in the world. Why? Because it would seem that God's purposes for permitting evil could be accomplished without permitting that much evil. You see how this argument works? It's a different kind of argument. It seems like a morally perfect, omnipotent God could accomplish His purposes, the same purposes, just as effectively without permitting so much evil. Now, another element that plays a role here is quality, not just quantity, but quality or character. All right. So now the question is, what kinds of evils has God permitted? It's not just how much evil God allows, but what kinds of evils God allows. And some evils are especially difficult to harmonize with the alleged good purposes of an all-powerful God. William Rowe gives as his example, his famous example, a fawn, a deer. Right? It starts off as a fawn, and before it reaches maturity, it is caught in a forest fire. Okay? And because of the smoke and the fire and the heat, the fawn runs and falls and breaks a leg and can't get up to save itself. And it gradually, slowly, painfully, right, dies of suffocation in this forest fire. Now, we're not talking about the profusion of evil anymore. We're talking about the character of evil. We're talking about the quality of evil. This seems to be the sort of evil that serves no good purpose at all. I mean, what good purpose could possibly be served by God's permission of such an evil? This is the question. Now, is evil of some kind compatible with the existence of God? Yes, that's not in question. But does it really make sense to believe that God is morally perfect and all-powerful if these sorts of things happen? These sorts of things. Now, not all evils are of this kind, but some are. And those are the ones that present a problem. Now, what problem is presented in each of these cases? In the case of the logical argument from evil, we have pretty clearly a rebutter, a rebutting defeater. Right? Because this is an argument from evil that directly attacks our belief that God exists. It takes the form of an argument that God does not exist. The evidential argument from evil, oddly enough, is really not an argument that God does not exist. At least that's not the best way to understand the argument. But if it's not an argument that God does not exist, then what is it? It's an argument that it is unreasonable for you or for me to believe that God exists. Maybe He does. But we couldn't be justified in believing that God exists, even if He does, because of the profusion and character of actual evils in the world. Some things are of such a peculiar kind of evil that it makes it very hard to believe in God, or else we say there's just too much evil. Right? Without saying that this means that God doesn't exist. You see the difference there? Now, is that a rebutting defeater, or is that an undermining defeater? Well, it depends on what it's attacking. If it's attacking the claim that God exists, it's really not a rebutting defeater, because it isn't an argument that God does not exist, is it? So maybe it's a special kind of undermining defeater. It's saying that your evidence that God exists is counterbalanced by this evidence that makes it unlikely that God exists. Now, some people would say this is still a rebutting defeater, but it's not an airtight rebutting defeater. It's a defeater of the claim that God exists, but only because it makes the existence of God unlikely, not because it makes the existence of God impossible. Okay? So you could construe the evidential argument from evil several ways. Or you could say that the evidential argument from evil may not be directly attacking either the claim that God exists or the evidence that God exists, but it attacks the claim that it's reasonable for me to believe that God exists. And in that case, it's a rebutter of my belief that it's reasonable to believe that God exists. Okay? Now, how do we respond to the evidential argument from evil? There really are two main strategies for responding to the evidential argument from evil. There is a third strategy that is especially pertinent to the evidential form of the argument from evil, but it is so special in character that I'm going to save it for a separate discussion. We'll talk about it tonight, but I want to talk first about two general strategies for responding to the evidential argument from evil. Okay? Typically, theists respond by offering what is called a theodicy. A theodicy. Does anybody here have any familiarity with this term? Have any ideas about what a theodicy is? Okay. Sometimes the whole project that we're engaged in tonight, including all the stuff we did talking about the logical argument from evil and everything we've said about the evidential argument and we're about to say, plus a whole bunch of stuff we won't have time to say, is all theodicy. It's trying to reconcile the existence of God with the reality of evil. And that's one way the term has been used. Right? It comes from two Greek terms, theos and dikos, God and righteousness. Right? And you're trying to establish that God is righteous. Right? Doesn't it say in the book of Genesis, in rhetorical fashion, shall not the judge of all the earth do right? Now, the reason why this is even a question is because there are occasions when we really wonder due to experiences that we have. But theodicy has a more precise, specialized use than that. And it comes in right here in response to the evidential argument from evil. A theodicy in this more precise or specialized sense is an exercise in formulating an account of God's possible and or actual reasons for permitting evil. Theodicy, then, is an account of God's possible and or actual reasons for permitting evil. It is a listing of the goods that morally justify God's permission of individual evils. This is theodicy. Now notice I say it's an account of God's possible and or actual reasons for permitting evil that would justify His permission of evil. What do I mean by possible? I mean that we can think of purposes that God would have that would be so good that these purposes would justify His permission of evil if those were His purposes, if those were His reasons. But we aren't committing ourselves to the actual existence of those reasons. We're not saying that we know that those are His purposes. Right? We're simply saying that these are purposes God could have for permitting evil. And if He had those purposes, then He would be justified in permitting those evils. And it could be a plurality of things. It doesn't have to be just one sort of thing that could function as a morally justifying reason for permitting evil. But the point in claiming that it's a possible reason for permitting evil is that we don't have to claim that we know this is God's actual reason. On the other hand, if a theodicy takes the form of an account of God's actual reasons for permitting evil, that's more ambitious. Now the claim is, these are the sorts of things that actually do justify God's permission of evil. Then the question becomes, well, now how do you know that those are God's reasons? It could be based on revelation. You'd have to have an argument for that. But as a matter of fact, I do think that the Bible, as a deposit of revelation from God, does include an account of some of the kinds of reasons God has for permitting evils. And I'll mention a couple of these in a moment. But understand, first of all, the general character of this type of reply to the evidential argument from evil. Now, what this particular reply does is it says, look, even those evils that look so curious in character, that make it seem so unlikely that God exists, could have justifying reasons within the will of God. And we don't even have to know what they are. Or maybe we can actually think of goods that God could produce as a result of permitting the evil of this kind or permitting this much evil. Now, let's talk about both the proliferation and the character of evil, both the quantity of evil and the quality of evil that we've talked about in connection with the evidential form of the argument. Let's take quantity. Does the atheist know how much of the evil that is real could be avoided without compromising God's good purposes in the world? The atheist is saying that apparently, there is more evil in the world than there has to be for God to accomplish His good purposes. He could accomplish those purposes just as effectively and yet more happily with less evil in the world. Maybe He couldn't accomplish His purposes with no evil in the world, but certainly He could apply, apparently we say, He could accomplish much of His goal, many of His goals, just as well without permitting evil. So why doesn't He do it? Now the question we have in response is, well, now how do you know that? We're not in an especially good position ourselves to make reasonable decisions about how much of the evil in the world really does depend on God's good purposes and how fully God's purposes could be realized without this much evil in the world. After all, we can think of possible and maybe even actual reasons that God could have for permitting a whole variety of evils in the world. Why should the actual amount of evil make a difference to our account? What about the character of evil then? What about things like the forest fawn? Well, it may be that we can't think of a good reason that God would have for permitting those evils. But should we think that because we can't think of a good reason that God would have for permitting those evils, that He wouldn't have a good reason? But the atheist says, but you're missing the point. Sure, God can know if He has good reasons or not, if He has justifying reasons or not. The point is, we don't know. And because we don't know, we're not justified in believing that God exists. Well, the theodicist might want to say, but we can think of justifying reasons for an awful lot of things. So why should we stumble over a few things that we can't account for, especially when it's God we're talking about? Well, that goes part of the way to responding to the evidential argument from evil. I think what you really have to do is take cases. Take the case of the forest fawn. Why is the forest fawn case so interesting? Why does William Rowe take the case of a forest fawn and not a philosophy professor at a university like Biola University? Gets trapped in the woods. There's a blazing fire. He's running for his life. He falls and breaks his leg. He can't get away soon enough, and he suffocates from smoke inhalation. Why isn't that his example?
The fawn is
completely innocent. That's certainly part of the story. What else?
God could use your death to bring your family to you.
There are all sorts of possibilities. Probably, chances are, if that happens to me, it's going to be discovered. Right? This could make a difference to the life of somebody else. This could pave the way to salvation for somebody. This could cause the family to come together in certain ways and to grow in virtue and character in certain ways. It may present the occasion for that, but not the guarantee of that. And these might be justifying reasons. Or it might even be that as I lie there in the woods contemplating my soon demise, something good takes place in my own soul in preparation for an afterlife or something. Now, I like to emphasize, when I talk about animal pain in these cases, I like to emphasize the important difference that Rowe thinks exists between humans and animals when it comes to pain and suffering. But notice, one reason why there's this difference is because animals and humans have a different consciousness. They make sense of their experiences in different ways. We act for purposes and goals and in intentional ways, when animals often act instinctively. And so we think there's a difference in consciousness between those kinds of animals and ourselves. Now, that's part of what constitutes the difference between the human and the animal placed in similar circumstances, and the reason why he wants to put the animal in those circumstances. But if you press that difference very far, you run up against how little we actually know about animal consciousness and pain, and the assimilation of pain experiences and pain stimuli in consciousness on the part of an animal. And if it should turn out that the animal does not really suffer in the way that you and I imagine we would if it was us in that situation, because it's an animal of a completely different kind, then the problem begins to lose its punch. Do you see that? So one of the responses to the evidential argument from evil is that you've got to take cases. And certainly if the atheist wants to say some kinds of evil are especially problematic for belief in God, then he's got to have certain kinds in mind, and you're entitled to ask him, well, now just what evils would you say are problematic in this sense? And then you examine the cases like we just did. Now, that's one type of response, to offer some sort of a theodicy. Now, to my mind, this is effective, and it's especially effective if you can say these are the actual reasons God has for permitting those sorts of evils or for permitting that much evil. Right? And not only that, but we can see that those reasons morally justify God's permission of evil. But you know what? We can't say that about very many of these things. It's very hard to make a convincing case that this degree of evil and these kinds of evils have precisely these specifiable, actual, morally justifying reasons so that there's nothing left over, nothing dangling. So there's not just a little bit of evil we haven't accounted for or some peculiar kind of evil we haven't accounted for. And that's why I have reservations about relying exclusively on this methodology. So what else do we say? We also need to take into consideration the positive evidence for the existence of God. The positive evidence for the existence of God. A God who is powerful enough to be judged all-powerful and wise enough to be judged omniscient and good enough to be considered morally perfect. One of the reasons why I titled my book on evil, Evil and the Evidence for God, is because in my judgment, one of the greatest, most effective responses to the evidential argument from evil is to present evidence for the existence of God that outweighs the evidence from evil. And when you do that, you're not presenting a theodicy. You're not giving an account of the possible or actual reasons God has for permitting evil that justify His permission of evil. What you're doing is you're giving somebody good reasons to believe that God exists and therefore good reasons to believe that God does have morally justifying reasons, even if you can't begin to understand what those reasons are. So if you have confidence that God exists, you don't need to have confidence that you know what particular good is served by every particular evil that happens. Because you've got enough evidence to believe that some good is served by His permission of every evil without knowing what it is, because you know He's good. You know He's powerful. Now, this means that you need to invite other lecturers to come into your class and present arguments for the existence of God. Arguments that reinforce the conviction that God is not just the creator of the origin of the universe, but that He created it for good purposes and that He looks after His universe and that He has certain goods for which He acted in producing this universe. This is why I think that the most appealing, fascinating version of the design argument for the existence of God is an argument based on cosmic constants, those things that establish the physical conditions of our universe in such an apparently, finely tuned fashion that if you just took one and altered it ever so slightly in any particular direction, you wouldn't get the universe that we have. In particular, you wouldn't get a universe inhabited with human beings, with human life, with moral responsibility and moral opportunity. The cosmic constants, the physical conditions of the universe, are numerous and complexly interrelated in such a way that if you began to tinker ever so slightly with just one of them, not to mention a whole range of them, you would get a very different result instead of this one that is the physical condition of human life. And I think that's evidence that God is good. I think that's evidence that God has a plan. I think that's evidence that God has a design that He acted for and towards in producing the universe and establishing these precise, finely tuned conditions for human flourishing. This is evidence of His goodness. And it would be evidence of this kind, as well as a whole range of other interrelated evidences for the existence and character of God, that I would want to bring in, I would want to introduce as positive evidence for the existence of God, that tells us that even if we don't know what reasons actually justify God's permission of evil, we have good reason to believe that He has reasons. He does have reasons that do justify Him in permitting every particular kind of evil and just as much evil as we actually find in the universe. Now, this allows for an element of mystery. But notice, it's not a mystery that God exists. It's a mystery how this God is actually justified in permitting the sorts of evils and the amount of evil that we actually find in the universe. It's not so mysterious that God exists. Evil doesn't really just count as powerful evidence that God does not exist, but it does generate curiosity on our part about how God is going to make everything whole again, how He's going to make everything work together for good, and how it's going to be right to say at the end of the age, the judge of all the earth has indeed done good and done right. Okay? So there's mystery, but it's not blind faith. It's confidence that there is a solution to the mystery, perhaps known only to God. So those are two things that I would suggest in response to the evidential argument from evil. Now let me give you this third thing that really is so special that you could use it in a variety of contexts when you encounter arguments from evil from atheologians and agnostics. Somebody like William Rowe, who argues that evil is evidence that God does not exist, but not conclusive evidence, puts himself in a position to agree that there really are evils in the world. You see, a person like J.L. Mackey or somebody else who endorses the logical argument from evil can say, look, evil is incompatible with Christian belief about God, about God's power and about God's goodness. But the atheist doesn't have to agree that there's evil in the world. He might even say, look, in my worldview, I agree, I can't really say that there are evils in the world. But my argument doesn't depend on the assumption that evil really exists. My argument depends on the assumption that theists believe that evil really exists. And that's incompatible with other things they believe. And I've heard atheists say this. I've heard atheists say, look, I acknowledge that if my worldview is correct, it's going to be pretty hard to say that this or that state of affairs really is evil. But see, you don't have that way out, right? You're a Christian. You believe in God. And you believe there really is evil in the universe. That's incompatible with your belief in God. See, that's something they can do here. But the evidentialist seems to be committed to the real existence of evil in the world. He wants to say, look, the kinds of evils that we really do find in the world make it unlikely that God exists. And the amount of evil that we really do find in the world makes it unlikely that God exists. This looks like a commitment to the real existence of evil in the world. And so you say to the atheist who likes this argument, tell me then, what is evil? What is evil? What is it that makes this state of affairs, but not this state of affairs, an instance of evil? Now, the atheologian has a dilemma on his hands here, because some accounts of the nature of evil, generally, will not be compatible with their worldview. And in fact, I think the most plausible characterizations of evil, generally, are going to actually be more compatible with theism than with atheism. I believe that evil is a departure from the way things ought to be. That's what I think evil is. I don't think that's a fully satisfying philosophical definition of evil, but I think it's a pretty good initial general characterization of evil. It's one that would meet with approval on the part of most people in the world, believers or not, who have no idea what we're talking about tonight. If you just said, would you agree that evil is a departure from the way things ought to be? I think you'd get pretty widespread agreement. But can the atheist agree with that conception of evil and avoid certain problems? It can be very difficult. Why is that? To say that evil is a departure from the way things ought to be is to say that there is a way things ought to be. Now, what are the determining conditions for how things ought to be in a naturalistic or atheistic world? A world without God. A world without a transcendent personal being of moral character with a design plan for the universe. I think the theist can give an account of this. On his view, there's no special design that the universe conforms to or departs from. Things just are the way they are. How can things just be any more than just the way they are? How can they be departures from how they ought to be? Now it looks like the theist is in a position to present a problem of evil for atheism. Now, I have talked to two friends of mine who are sophisticated atheist philosophers. William Rowe is one and Paul Draper is another. And I've asked them, what would you say evil is? And what account of the nature of evil would you give that you would say is compatible with your naturalism, with your atheism? Professor Rowe said, well, how about this? And I thought this was very interesting because he didn't want to say, well, I think it's this. He said, what about this? So it's very experimental and tentative and provisional. He didn't just, you know, grab the branch and cling to it. He wanted to give himself some scope for coming up with some other ideas. He said, how about this? Evil is an intrinsically bad state of affairs. Well, I think what you've done is you've traded the word evil in for the word bad, and then the question is, okay, now what makes a state of affairs bad? Intrinsic or not, what makes it bad is that it's a departure from the way things ought to be. Now, what makes one state of affairs different than another state of affairs is that it's somehow, in some sense, a departure from the way this is. But that wouldn't make it bad, right? Being different wouldn't be bad. Or being unwelcome by me wouldn't necessarily make it bad, right? What makes it bad is that it shouldn't be that way. It should not be that way. Ah, so how should it be? And what determines that? Not human predilection, surely. That wouldn't make it especially evil in a profound, deep, objective sense. What did Paul Draper say? Now, in this case, I asked Paul Draper this in a public meeting. I was presenting a paper, and he had already presented a paper. And I said, now, it'd be interesting to see what Paul has to say about this particular claim I'm making. And so he waited until almost the end of the discussion. And he said, you know, how about this? And it was so interesting to see him preface his remarks in the same way, with this kind of provisional, tentative commitment. And it sounded to me like he wanted to say that evil might be a social artifact. It's a matter of our perceptual experience of the world. And that evil is like money, right? A dollar bill is just a piece of paper with ink on it, as a matter of physical stuff. But it comes to have additional properties under certain social conditions that are specifiable by us. And so we agree to let that thing function a certain way in society, and it represents something for us. And that's all evil is. But now, if you say that, then you've given up the game too, because now evil is not fundamentally evil or bad. Right? It's just a social construction. It's just, and then you can have different social contexts where some think that these things are bad and others think that this is bad, and they're not wrong. And there's no genuine disagreement here because they just have different feelings about these states of affairs. Now, how could that count against the existence of God? See, so I've come to really appreciate this particular challenge for the person who's fallen back on the evidentialist argument from evil. Pray tell, what then is evil, if not a departure from the way things ought to be? And if it is that, then how do you get that without God, who would ground a design plan, who would be the one who determines the conditions of how things ought to be, such that a departure from that not only is evil, not only is an intrinsically bad state of affairs, but is a violation of the will of God, which is what sin is. So what have we done? We've characterized evil, the problem of evil, as a kind of defeater of theistic belief. But it has various versions. In the main, the versions are the logical argument from evil, which claims that it is logically inconsistent, contradictory, to believe that God is all-powerful, morally perfect, and that there's evil in the world. The evidential argument claims that certain types of evils and perhaps the degree of evil that we find in the world is what makes it unlikely that God exists, even though it's still logically possible that God exists. We argued that the logical argument from evil is invalid, apart from certain assumptions, which probably aren't true. So this is not a very good argument, and we noted that contemporary atheologians like William Rowe and others have abandoned this argument in favor of the evidential argument, thinking that this is a stronger argument. But I've tried to offer three different strategies for replying to the evidential argument from evil, including the formulation of a theodicy in terms of either actual or possible reasons God could have for permitting the kinds and amounts of evil that we find in the world, presenting positive evidence for the existence of God, and then raising, finally, the question for the evidentialist, what is evil, if not a departure from the way things ought to be, which implies a design plan, which has objective purchase in our experience only if it's backed by a transcendent personal being of moral dimensions like God.